This is Bob Lang, oral historian. Today is August 16th, 2013. This is for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives. This oral history interview is with Emeritus Professor John Skinner of the Department of Poultry Science and the UW Extension. And this is part two of his interview, following up on the first part we held yesterday, August 15th, 2011. So, John, we wanted to pick it up today with a review of some of the key events in your career that we didn't touch on yesterday.
All right. We probably should say that the highlight of my career was to be elected into the American Poultry Hall of Fame. I was the youngest person at that time to be so recognized.
And what were you recognized for, and what year was that?
The year was 1989, and the recognition was for contribution to the poultry industry in total. Not for one specific thing, but the broad base of contributions to the research and experiences that I had had as a person participating in history-making events.
Can you give me a little more detail on that? What your contributions had been in research as well as publicity?
I contributed to causing the research community to broaden their base. A lot of times people get pretty narrow in their when they're thinking, and they concentrate terribly deeply in one specific area, but they don't spread it out and apply it to other phases of the industry. Mm-hmm. And I was recognized for being able to cause the fancier breeders that had poultry for a hobby to team with the commercial interests, and I worked with both sides of the fence.
Uh-huh. That would be tricky.
Yes.
I would think.
It was very tricky, and you had to be aware of the mentality that you were dealing with on each side of the issue.
Right. Yes, because the researchers and the commercial angles come at problems quite differently.
Yeah, and the commercial industry measures their success on the average, and the fancier breeder measures success on the individual bird.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So in 1989, you were 65.
Yeah.
And so you were the youngest at age 65 to be made a member?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty impressive.
They elect a maximum of 5 people every 3 years.
Oh, my.
It started in 1952. So I was about number, I'd have to figure it out to be accurate, but someplace around 60. People.
And were you the only one from Wisconsin who was
No.
in that?
Wisconsin has the greatest number of members of the Hall of Fame of any university.
Really? More than Cornell?
Yeah.
Boy, that's quite impressive.
Cornell was early, but they didn't have as much numbers to work with. I was a member of the committee that dealt with Cornell as a repository for historic literature.
I've had the sense that Cornell was, and perhaps still is, considered one of the leading departments of poultry science.
It was the cornerstone that a lot of it rested on.
Oh. And you knew a lot of the people at Cornell, did you?
Yes. I visited Cornell as a guest on occasion and a guest lecturer.
Mm-hmm. Well, where was that convention when you were sworn in to the Hall of Fame?
That was held in Indiana, Purdue University.
Did a lot of your colleagues come to that?
Yeah, there was approximately 250 or 2,500.
Wow.
It was Poultry Science Annual Meeting, and they had read sort of biographical sketch of each one of us and the person who nominated us. And Jimmy Gwynn from Ralston Purina Company was my sponsor.
Oh. So this wasn't a surprise to you. You knew you'd been nominated.
I knew that I'd been nominated. In fact, I served on the committee that evaluated the nominations for a while. And I resigned from it to when I knew I had been nominated.
Uh-huh. Well, that was probably a good decision.
Yeah, it could have been a fixed injury.
Although it doesn't sound to me like you needed any fixing to help you get the honor.
It was strange to read my nomination letters and recommendation and people giving me credit for things they were doing. And that kind of weighs the substance of the nomination if you can be tied to other people that benefited from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. So did you give a speech when you were named?
No, just an acceptance remark, shortly.
Yes. Well, and I suppose that's the greatest honor in your mind that you could receive.
Yeah, that's the thing that stands out. Because there was a lot of people nominated that were pretty competent.
Yeah. Do they still do that every year?
Yes.
Or every three years? Do you think Mark Cook will be nominated someday?
He might. He stands a good chance of it, but you darn near have to have a personal interest in the form of your sponsor.
Well, he's still fairly young. So.
Yeah, he is pretty young for it, and you can write a speech that has the dynamics of a winner, but if you don't have all the facts, you can't make it stand up against others.
Correct. You are right. Yesterday, just to move on, John, you were telling me about the dinner in London when you and Gene were invited to represent, I think, the United States Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
Can we get that story for the record?
Well, the European Poultry Conference was held in London in 82, and I was a delegate, and my wife was named too, and we give Wood Jenkins, the federal extension polterman at the time, a lot of credit for nominating me, because he knew I wanted to go as just a private individual, and so he made it possible for me to be a delegate from USDA.
And you were the only delegate from the USDA?
No, there was a man from California, and I know him well, if I can just think of his name. I can't say his name.
Yeah. Okay.
But he was, I think there was three of us.
Oh.
He was one of them, and there was another man from California. No, I'll tell you who it was. The other man was from Purdue. And shut the machine off for a minute. I'm just turning it on.
Okay. So we were in the midst of talking about your going to the 1982 poultry conference in Europe.
Yeah. European poultry science.
In London, when you were one of three delegates from the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was, oh, come in.
No. Okay. Okay, we're back on.
We were invited, my wife and I, of course, because we were traveling together and both representing the same interest. And we stayed in a bed and breakfast in London. I had gone to it several times. And we got out of our bed and breakfast to go to the banquet at the Minister of Agriculture, the residence. We rode a subway and to the nearest stop, and we walked down the aisle, alley, to the minister's house to be introduced. And we come out of at the corner of the house and out of the alley, and turned on the sidewalk, and the footman, he looked at us standing beside the Rolls Royce and all the fancy cars that were pulling up there, and they each had a letter of invitation, and guy that was reading them off and advancing you up the stairs and then announcing your name looked at us as though we were poor white trash. And he said, "What are you here for?" I said, "I'm invited, or we're invited. You have an invitation?" And I pulled it out of my pocket. "Yes, I do, sir." And he said, "I can't believe this, but there must be a mistake." And he talked to the footman at the door that was supposed to announce us. And they looked at the letter closely and said, "Well, I guess it's authentic." And Mr. and Mrs. Skinner from USDA in America.
Well, at least you did get announced.
Yeah. It was questionable because they were stepping us aside, pushing it aside and announcing the people getting out of these limousines.
Yeah.
And footmen holding the door of the car for them.
Yeah.
I had, or we had several experiences that were just totally different. And wasn't a heck of a lot of research read at that conference, and they were not being very scientific with their presentations. I was amazed. I thought that it would be more formal. But the speakers were on. One I could recall was from France, and he made them. When he got it, his turn for the presentation, he asked for an interpreter. Why? And the master of ceremony said, "Why do you want that? I am French." And I heard him say, "Well, you speak English well, and most of the audience will be English, and you're in England." He held his breath and said he's entitled to a speaker and interpreted French, and he wanted it handled that way.
So did he give his speech in French?
Yeah. He deliberately gave it in French. He could speak English. I visited with him a bit because I thought this was a unique individual. Mm-hmm. That was the outstanding thing of that conference in London. I attended the European Poultry Conference, which is held every 4 years, three times.
Oh. And with the support of the department, so they wanted you to go.
Yeah, but I was already retired.
Oh, this was after you were retired.
Yeah.
Now, did you do, I think you did, quite a bit of overseas work while you were on the faculty, didn't you?
Not as much as it seemed like. I did took a lot of slides and like my camera and give speeches after I come back here. Mm-hmm. Of what was going on in Europe. Mm-hmm. I didn't, my employment wasn't really in Europe. It was loyal to the U.S. I wasn't on anybody's payroll.
When you went to Europe, were you learning things that you did not know?
Yes, I learned a lot of things that I wasn't aware of ahead of time. When I attended a short course in Sussex, England, I was a student, or registered as a student, and treated as a student. And they had processing laboratory, and they didn't have running water in the slaughter. If they soiled the carcass, they'd had dry absorbent cloth, little squares of cloth they picked up and wiped the manure off of the board.
That doesn't seem very sanitary, does it?
It wasn't to my standards.
Would you say generally the cultivation of poultry was much more advanced in the United States than in Europe?
It was bigger units.
Bigger units.
The organizations like Highline and DeKalb and Babcock had set up distribution points in Europe, and they were flying baby chicks across, hatched in the United States and grown in Europe.
Huh. Was poultry as popular in Europe as it was in the United States?
They hadn't made it a year-round crop of chicken raising, and it's still pretty much seasonal. But the thing of it was, you didn't have restrictions against keeping poultry in town.
Yeah, so a lot of people had chickens in the backyard, I assume.
Yeah, in the suburbs of the cities, there was rabbits and chickens were frequently some. Rabbits didn't make any noise, of course, but they were there. I went to an animal production conference in Holland, in Utrecht, Holland, and they had a dinner there that at the Burgomeister's house, and we just the delegates. Jane wasn't with me at that day, and so it was just a male assemblage, and the females that were involved in poultry industry were actually struggling for their position.
They were not welcome, I take it?
They were thought to be invading the male's domain.
You didn't feel that way, did you?
I didn't feel that way because they were accepted in the United States. My wife would have objected most strenuously if I had discriminated against them.
Oh, good for Jean. You mentioned yesterday, I thought, that you had done some work in Africa.
No, I traveled in Africa, but I hadn't done any work there.
Oh, I see.
That was, I can say that in Africa, they kept chickens on the roof of big apartment houses.
Hmm. Really?
You could buy baby chicks in the feed store, take them home and raise them on the roof of your house, and butcher them and slaughter them for personal use.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the fancy bird industry, pigeons and parrots and a lot of the wild birds that they consume were raised on rooftop aviary.
Before we turned on the machine, you were starting to tell me about a conference you attended in Malta. What was that about?
That was a European poultry conference, and about a sixth, I think, meeting of the scientific community, and it was in Malta. And Malta is a small island in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. So Gene was attending a genealogy conference and meeting in London on the same week, just fortunately. And she took off and went into the Netherlands and then back to London. Mm-hmm. And I took off separately, went to Amsterdam, transferred to Rome, and then shuttled a plane from Rome to Malta. And it was kind of strange. In Rome, I had to pay to get my luggage. I could see my luggage in through a wire enclosure in the airport, but I couldn't retrieve it without going outside, and I had to pay an admission to get back in the airport. And it was funny, kind of scary really to me, because I saw the crew coming for the plane to man the plane that was going to go to Malta. And it was a fairly small plane, but the crew were laughing and joking like they were having a party. And I didn't think they were very serious for going over the water. And you got you didn't need to fly very high over the Mediterranean. And it was a small plane, and you could see in all directions, you thought, but you couldn't see anything down. And they announced that they were starting the descent for the Malta airport, and I didn't see anything ahead of the water.
A little scary.
And then we run into... I went to my meeting in Malta for about 3 days, and Gene flew from London to Malta. And we booked a passage from here, and everything was going all right. And then come the 1st of September, and the announcement in the papers were tourist season was considered over, and the airlines would be on reduced schedule. And there was a lot of us in the same boat that had gone to this conference. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't put on extra planes, and they could only hold so many. And we waited it got too late to get her seat on the plane, and then I'd been booked about 2 weeks wait, and I didn't want to spend 2 weeks in Malta.
You had to wait 2 weeks?
Yeah, because there was that much. There's just darn near no air travel off of Malta after the 1st of September. And so I said, well, there has to be a way to deal with this. And we checked in the hotel, and they said, well, you might be able to get passage on a freight boat out of North Africa. And we said, well, if that's the choice we got, we better take it. And so we got just 1 day wait for a boat coming out of North Africa, and he said it'd be a tramp steamer. And this rusty bucket of bolts showed up at the dock when we were waiting for it. And I looked at Jean, and she said, do you feel lucky? And I said, I don't think we got a choice. And so we walked up the gangplank carrying our suitcases, and got to the purser on the boat that he was standing on the dock, and he took our passports. And there we were on a thing that didn't look like it was very safe, and nobody but us to speak English. And I don't know if they understood English or not. I imagine some of them did understand a little of it, but couldn't speak it. And so we took turns for the one-day cruise to Sicily. Because we, you know, from Sicily we could activate our rail passes. But we got to Sicily and had an overnight accommodation on a train that run onto a barge. And we woke up in a suburb of Rome the next morning.
So all's well that ends well.
Yeah.
You didn't have any trouble on the tramp steamer, did you?
No, but the passports were in boxes on the, there wasn't very many passengers on it, it was all freight. Mm-hmm. And the passports were unguarded and unclothed, they just loose in a cheese box on the deck.
Oh, that would be scary.
And we, decided that one of us would stay within sight of it all the time.
Yeah. But you got them back, I take it, without problem.
And they had strips of newspaper for bookmarkers in the passports when they handed them back to us.
Hmm. What year is this?
It was probably 86.
Right after you retired.
Yeah. We were fortunate to get to travel a lot after I retired, and I went to Europe once a year when I was working. But we sometimes made two trips to Europe or someplace after I was free in 21.
Other conferences, John, from your list that you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know. One time it was, we were... I was still employed, and we went to France, and I was gonna take pictures of poultry shows that I could use back here for lectures and my work. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that the rail was on strike, and we were out of London, or out of Paris, and we were probably 30 miles out in the countryside in this equivalent to a state fair. And I was taking pictures of it and one thing another, but there was no announcements at the depot that the rail was on strike when we went to come back to Paris. And they said that it was only the conductors that were on strike. The train crew was running the show, but they made some kind of excuse that the different unions were handling it differently. And some of them were on strike and some weren't. And the trains were running because they had to keep it on schedule or the track was committed to another train.
Right.
And we managed to get back to Paris because that return trip was scheduled and they would accept our entry to the depot. And there was protest lines and strike lines that we were faced with. And we got back to Paris and And they said, how did you manage to get back? Well, we just got on the train. Well, did they check your tickets? No, they didn't check your tickets.
So you sort of got a free ride.
Yeah, we got a free return.
And this, now yesterday I think you said that the university gave you a sabbatical
yeah.
at some point. When was that?
That was in 69.
And what did you do with that sabbatical?
I registered for a short course in Plumpton Agricultural College in Lewes, Sussex, England. And I was a student, and they wouldn't let me stay in the student dormitory. Hmm. You were a titled professor, and you have a separate accommodation next to the dean's office. And the woman will bring you a cup of tea at 7 o'clock and wake you in the morning.
That's pretty nice.
And you'll eat your meals in the dining hall and at the faculty table, but you have to sit at the lower end of the faculty table because you're not our faculty.
Boy, lots of class-related rules, aren't there?
Yes, there certainly were. And they had colored cloth napkins, but you used the same napkin for the three meals a day. Hmm. And you had to keep track of the color of yours to get it on the right peg.
Hmm. So Jean wasn't with you for that?
No, she was staying in London, and she got to see the coronation of Elizabeth. And was in the audience when she was coronated.
Oh, in 1952?
That was in 1969.
Oh, I thought she'd been coronated earlier, but maybe not.
I think she was in the process of being coronated over a period of time.
Oh, I see.
But the formal, the last stamp on the letter was for 69, because it was our 25th wedding anniversary. And
oh, exciting.
She said, Jean said, I'm going to London, or going to France in London. If you don't want to go along, you can stay behind. And she knew that wouldn't happen. And we paid, I think it was £2 a night for bed and breakfast. And to keep it going, we had to pay for her room and as if I was with her. You didn't reduce the rate.
No, probably not.
But that one of the things I remembered was the dressing of poultry with wiping dry cloths on the skin to reduce contamination.
Right. Yeah.
And you had a table with just wiped off with greasy cloth, and you had the carcasses on that when you were dressing it. Hmm. Then when the instructor found out that I was titled professor from the United States, he made sure that I got reminded of that on every lecture. We have a guest with us this time.
Uh-huh.
And he said in the final breakdown of the summary of the course, this is the first time that I've ever taught the person that ranked me.
Really? Yeah. Well, that clearly they recognized you as someone special.
young. And I told them repeatedly that I wanted to be treated just like they treated one of their local students.
No, no, that wouldn't happen. No, you were a full professor.
Yeah.
It sounds like you spent quite a bit of time in England.
I spent a lot of time in England. I've been in every corner of the island. And I spent time in Wales and Scotland.
Did you look up where your family came from?
Yes. And we found, we knew that it was Falkland.
Way up there.
Yeah. It was, my family came from... I can't say the name of it, but a village just outside of
Inverness?
And we... had several good experiences, but the first one was we rode a bus from Edinburgh out to, actually took a train up to the east coast of Scotland and then got a country bus to go into Fife. And we walked into the cemetery and we got the bus to stop us let us off as we passed the cemetery going into Falkland. And we walked into the cemetery and it was sort of like a wishbone, pathways in it. And Jean said, I'll take the right one, you take the left one, and we'll see if we can find grave markers. And she hollered at me across the way about 2 minutes into the walk, and she said, come here, you won't believe this. Here was the headstone for John and Jean Skinner.
Wow.
And we knew it had to be right because the grave markers had the occupation of the people that were interred there. And so we come back there to that town several times and that trip. And we walked out in the country and a little village, just sort of a crossroads village. And Jean said, grandparents were born here. Where can you show me where I can look for them? And she was standing on a stone and it was in this little street. And it was a flat stone, and some lady living close by saw her standing on that stone, and we come out and ask her what she was doing. She said, well, we're trying to find the ancestors. And, well, she said, you're standing on the stone that was in the front, on the front door, or at the front door, of Robert Skinner. And they talked for a little while, and I was walking around and looking at the buildings, and I saw a residence that had a little building in back of it, and a garden fence on the roof. And I knocked on the door and I said, would you tell me what you got in that building? And he said, you know what I got in that building, the racing pigeons. And he took me through the yards and all. He was a pigeon fancier. He said that the road had been widened when they took the dray wagons through in place of horseback ride. And that was a stepping stone of the Skinner household that she was standing on. Somehow we got connected with a lady that knew the history of the family, and she said that cottage that they lived in was built in 1755.
Wow. This must have been quite exciting in a way.
It really was, because you were walking in history.
Yeah.
Reliving. And they value their history more than we do.
Yes, they do.
One thing that I run into, because I was interested in museums and restoring old equipment, and they told me that a true Scotsman doesn't replace anything. He just he doesn't duplicate it. He just puts a piece in that was damaged. They restore it and don't replace it.
Right. Thrifty.
And I went back to that museum in Reading, England, where I was informed of that several times over the years, because I got to know the director of, he would be a curator. And so I valued his counsel, and I had met because I was dealing in antique books as one of my retirement projects, and I got acquainted with a lady that was a book dealer in England, and I bought quite a bit of stuff from her and sold her quite a bit of stuff over the years. And her father was a clockmaker.
What kind of antique books did you collect?
On poultry.
On poultry.
In fact, you can see on the wall there are some tear sheets out of early...
Oh, that colored rooster?
Yeah. The book stalls on the Seine River in Paris are just full of antique books and antique paper.
Right. It's so much fun to walk.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
One thing I remember about Paris that our trips was you don't want to pay for a meal with a big piece of paper. You don't have a big bill, because you aren't conversant enough in their material to get the right change back. And you give your money to the waiter, and he goes in the back room, and somebody else brings the change out.
Yeah. Were you in Paris several times?
Yeah.
You and Jean must have liked Paris.
I didn't think much of Paris. It was always on the alert for being taken advantage of.
A lot of pickpockets in Paris.
Yes, there are. And there was, we went and visited the Paris Zoo one time, and a little kid come up to me as we were leaving the zoo, and he had a piece of cardboard about a foot and a half long with the ends turned up, and he had some buddies with him, and he was wanting to talk to me. And I couldn't figure him out until I realized that he was pushing that cardboard against my chest and raising it up to get anything I had in my inside pockets out. He'd fall to the ground, and he'd run down and take off.
Yeah. Big cities are kind of that way.
Yeah, and they had in Brussels. We were there many times, and they would announce in the rail stations, because we were always riding rail passes, they would announce in the rail stations at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon to beware of your luggage and don't set it down, and there are pickets on us, they'd say.
Well, at least they gave you sort of a heads up. About
They were. Belgium was a neat town or country. It was small. The average size of a farm in Belgium at that time was 2 acres.
Really? That's not very big at all. How big was your family's farm in Nebraska?
80 acres. It was a small farm for that area.
Yeah.
Most of them were starting at 160.
John, did you and Jean ever get to Asia in your travels? Japan or China?
No. When we took the sabbatical leave in 69, I had 8 weeks, and we did a lot of different things. And I found in my travels later on that I first experienced it in 69. When you're away from home about 3 weeks, you got to take a day off and rest up. Mm-hmm. You're just tired of absorbing so much.
Tired of every day trying to figure out how to get along.
Yeah, and we didn't take advantage of tour guides for quite a few years, but we finally would combine about a 10-day tour of some corner of the world and then stay on another week on our own to go back and get a better look at some of the things.
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
And one thing that we did was Jean would be in the Society of Genealogists Library in London on King's Row, and I'd be going around to other interest areas. And I went out to the Farnsworth Agricultural Station and looked over their facilities. And they had thatched roofs on their chicken houses. And the sparrows would nest in the thatch. Hmm. And they had trouble with rats in the thatch.
I suppose.
And then it'd affect their research because the rats had consumed the food that was set aside for the experimental animals.
It almost sounds like 18th century rather than the 20th century.
They paid a lot of attention to the appearance of things. For instance, I had a visit with the cousin of my dad's that was the manager of a pretty big estate, and he wanted to put up harvester silos. Mm-hmm. And they said, yes, you can have a permit to put up a harvest store, but you got to paint it green.
No blue ones, huh?
No blue ones.
Interesting.
And you had to get a hold of a foundation to put a new house up. They were controlling the spread of the cities that way. My dad, one of my dad's cousins had been in the United States, and I knew him from when I was a little kid. And he'd gone back to England when he came over here, and he was a butler for a while for a family in Connecticut. And then he came to Nebraska and was kind of a pal with my Uncle Jim. And one of the things he did was he had a 1932 Plymouth car with the ignition switch on the left-hand side of the steering wheel. And he convinced me that that was for left-handed drivers. Let's see. I don't know if I got anything here that well, the thing that I was interested in a lot when what got me to Wisconsin was my interest in waste disposal. Mm-hmm. And to me, waste is just energy in a different form.
Huh. Was there faculty here who were known for studying waste?
No. I was plowing new ground for them.
So why did you come here to study waste?
Well, they invited me. And I was doing chores in Nebraska. I had the random sample turkey test in my office. I had the market news service for poultry and eggs in my office. I had the Turkey Federation secretaryship in my office. And I was invited a lot to go the extra mile of service order, and I wasn't plowing my own ground.
Uh-huh.
And they turned me loose. When I come to Wisconsin, I really was turned loose.
Uh-huh.
Professor Bird managed to get me here with my rank and tenure and no PhD, and I wasn't getting anywhere in Nebraska, so my mother had passed away, and so I wasn't using that for an excuse to stay close by.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that a lot of poultry research people had their base training here in Wisconsin, and I thought there might be a place for me there too. But I didn't do a heck of a lot of research. I was more a publicity man.
Mm-hmm.
And that was by my choosing, because I had made friends quick on with the agricultural editor for the State Journal here and the agricultural editor for the Milwaukee Sentinel.
Hi.
Come in.
You said yesterday that when you came here, they basically said, work on what you want to work on.
That's right.
And so you started in, before you were doing publicity, you started in on waste?
I was talking of the fact that waste was misnomer. Waste is just energy in another form. Mm-hmm. And I managed to, when I was in Nebraska, to get the first agricultural waste management conference. So it was held, and it was 3 days long, and I managed to get the newspapers and publicity to look at it in a different light.
That would have been quite an accomplishment to get them to look at the issue of waste as not waste.
They went about, well, it was 69 that they had the waste conference. I had convinced them that they ought to take on a national effort in that. And they asked me to be the featured speaker at the final banquet. And I said, all right. I was going to Europe, and it was just the weekend following my return from Europe. I was in the throes of their conference here, and they included all species of livestock. And they asked me to try to liven it up. And so I used the expanse of what I had done with the sod farm industry, and which was pretty good here, and between here and Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen the fields of sod.
And I convinced him to start pelleting the grass clipping and use them for cat litter.
Use them for what?
Cat litter. And it makes sense, because the chlorophyll in the green plant material is a good odor control.
Oh. Huh. Oh, interesting.
And so we set up a pelleting machine over here near Sullivan, Wisconsin, that was not being used for feed mixing. And so we pelleted the grass clippings, and then broke the pellets in a grinder and put it in sacks, and it was distributed in New York City.
Are they still doing that?
As far as I know, they are.
I didn't realize that about grass clippings as a deodorant for cat litter.
It was darn good. I didn't do a heck of a lot of research here at Wisconsin, because I was in so many public events, and I had speaking tours just almost constantly with animal rights and animal welfare, and
mostly in the state?
Yeah. But I did get called out. One time in Arkansas, I had a turkey meeting, and they wanted me to come down and deal with the animal welfare people that were trying to get them to stop feeding so much energy to gist of it was that they wanted me to buffer the people that were against big agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so I did my best to tell them that when we dubbed a chicken, that is, remove the comb and wattle, we were actually doing cosmetic surgery. And I took the approach that I wanted to get to know the opposition, and I'd listen to them. I wouldn't argue with them, I'd listen to them. Mm-hmm. And they had me teach a course for one semester at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus, because there was a lot of opposition to force feeding and multiple litters of the pigs in a year and all like that. And I tried to tie them to things that we did for human beings.
Did you get a respectful hearing?
Yes. They would shake their heads, but they'd stay in their seats to see what had to come next.
Did you like teaching?
Yes. I never took education course in my college career, but I was listed as teaching faculty.
And did you come by your ability to teach naturally, or had you had practice somewhere?
Not really. I just fell into it. And they let me go my way. Mm-hmm. The course that originated, I mentioned, I think, yesterday, was biology and appreciation of companion animals, and that was an area that hadn't been taught at college level anywhere. Mm-hmm. But you add up, you went to the pet magazines and the pet stores and listened to them, and you come up with some pretty good figures, and I got them to editors of two pet magazines to publish articles on the value of the pet food industry. And it's a sizable one.
Yes, I'm sure it is. You go into the supermarket and there are...
They put quite a bit of shelf space out for...
A huge amount.
And it's more now than it was when I was working it.
I'm sure that's true.
I kind of looked at the situation over, and Herb Bird was the poultry department chairman, and he was just as good as he could be to me, because he turned me loose. Mm-hmm. And I worked usually 7 days a week.
I know you said that yesterday. John, were you ever recruited to leave Wisconsin?
Yes. I had the opportunity to go to Pennsylvania. I had the support of the USDA to come to Washington, D.C.,
And why didn't you?
It would be too much traveling. I wouldn't have been home alone.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever regret that decision?
No. I fell into a niche that I fit here.
Yeah.
And I felt I could do more good here and be happier here than I would be commuting in Washington.
Well, I think that's true. It's a real mess out there, and was even back then.
One of my students, the Texas A&M, and he followed me to Nebraska and did a master's and occupied half of the extension office with me. Got to the extension poultryman for Oregon, and he was a fellow that had one hand off, and he was an interesting soul because he could do a lot of things, but he was kind of shoved aside by his family. And he took up with me, and when he got better grades by my giving him a key to my office on the farm at Texas A&M, mm-hmm. so he could have a place to study. And he had come to Nebraska, and his first child took his first long steps in my living room. And he... he was a heck of a good guy, but he knew that I was being coached to go to Washington, D.C., and he said, "Are you really interested in going to Washington, D.C. as a federal extension poultryman?" And I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "That's good, then I'll apply for it, but I wouldn't ever serve it. Or to be accused of being competitive with you."
Did he get that job?
Yeah.
Did you stay in touch with him over the years?
Yes.
What was his name?
Ken Holloman.
Is he still alive?
No. He died rather young, and he lived long enough to retire from Oregon and then take up a position with their overseas cooperation with Yemen.
Oh, really?
And he went to Europe, or the Middle East. And his wife was a charming person. And he was, he was 19 and she was 17 when they got married.
Just a little younger than when you and Jean got married.
Yeah.
You were 20 and she was 18, right?
No, she was 21.
Oh, that's right. She was 6 months older than you.
Yeah. I never regretted the move that I made. And I always had multiple offers in my pocket when I did.
Yeah. Other things about your professional career that we should get on record?
I always looked for areas of that were not being adequately addressed. Mm-hmm. I didn't push anybody else out of anything. I always plowed new ground.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other new areas that you went into?
Oh, gosh. I initiated call-in questions on television for pet, pet doctors, the title, and Dick Bristol, associate dean of School of Veterinary Medicine, we played it together, and Channel 3 had Lynn Cullen as a MC for a lot of call-in shows, and she was sort of our coach in a sense, but we'd get to the call-in for the pet doctor's program at 5 o'clock on Friday evenings. And she'd get them, or we'd pick them up from the switchboard at the studio, and she'd go through them and pick out the ones that she thought would stump us.
Oh.
And one of my constant hecklers was a Catholic priest in Middleton.
Really?
I said one time, "You realize that I'm not Catholic. I know you're not, but you don't know you're not."
You have met a wide variety of people.
And they all were good to me.
Yes, you have maintained that.
I'm sorry my memory isn't as good anymore, that I can't recall as much that might have been of interest to people, but...
We've got quite a bit of good information, particularly yesterday. And some of your comments...
3 o'clock.
Yeah, so it is. Some of your comments today will be of value to future historians.
Well, I never wanted to move anybody out of their territory. I always looked for new ground to plow.
Yeah. John, I think we're moving to the end of the interview. I think we've got some good information. Let me just ask you if there's anything you would like to say in closing about your career or about the University of Wisconsin.
Well, the University of Wisconsin treated me superbly well. They let me plow my own ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they always encouraged me to combine with people from other departments. I had a good relationship with Aggie Kahn, and they published papers with me in it, and I probably give them associate editorship in the publication. Mm-hmm. The same is true for Ag Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my chief, Ag Econ and Ag Engineering. And I did a lot of writing, and it tied in real well with one time I took a lectureship with a course in UW-Milwaukee, and it addressed the animal welfare, animal rights issue, and then I was in deeply involved in right to farm and zoning.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug Yang and the ag engineer, and he was in the Department of Ag Economics, and we published a paper on keeping livestock in city area.
Oh. Were you in favor of that or against it?
I was in favor of treating it so that it could be acceptable.
Uh-huh.
And rabbits were particularly a good example of something that can be kept in close, settled areas because they don't make any noise.
Yeah, that's true. They don't. I hadn't thought about that. Unlike the chickens that might greet the dawn.
Chickens got to be acceptable as a family with males and females involved. They've got to be enclosed.
Mm-hmm. Unlike the chickens that might greet the dawn.
Chickens got to be, to be acceptable as a family with males and females involved, they've got to be enclosed. Mm-hmm. I had my own chicken house in Middleton, and they never had any trouble with me.
Did you collect eggs?
Enough to reproduce them. I wasn't interested in keeping them for eggs. I was practicing them as part of my equipment for teaching artificial insemination. Mm-hmm. Because I was concerned that the people that were dealing with endangered species were getting their animals imprinted on them personally, and they wouldn't mate naturally. Fran Hammerstrom with the DNR was up at Plainfield in central Wisconsin, and she was a very interesting lady, but I couldn't come to her house at mealtime because she was keeping roadkill behind the cook stove.
Oh, yeah. No, you shouldn't have, and I'm glad you didn't. Well, John, any other concluding remarks?
Well, Wisconsin was altogether different than Nebraska. I was a chore boy in Nebraska, but I actually blossomed out when I got to Wisconsin.
That's great.
And they encouraged me to be a public figure here. And for extension, that's pretty important.
Essential. Well, okay, I think I'm going to conclude this here. We've got another hour and a half of interviews, and we had we had 2.5 hours yesterday.
Yeah.
So we've got close to 4 hours of you.
Well, you ought to be able to pick something out of there worthwhile.
I would agree. So this now concludes the oral history interview with Professor John Skinner on... Friday, August 16th, 2013. Thank you so much, John.
Well, it's been a pleasure to visit with you.